This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. An Indiana food bank has started a new online series aimed at shedding light on food insecurity. The episodes feature various guests and those working to find a way to solve and bring attention to hunger. It's called Feeding the Future and is hosted by Gleaners Food Bank President and CEO John Elliott. We actually happen to have him here with us right now. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Let's start with this series, an online series. I think it's pretty unique to see sort of in this realm. How did it get started?
Well, we were looking for a practical way that we could connect with people who are admittedly some working at home, some not. I think people are scattered. It's harder to reach a large collective audience. And frankly, our audience has gotten more complex at the same time that our work and our mix of activities has gotten more complex.
Did you think that a video series would be a great way to reach folks all over the place?
Well, yes, to reach a variety of audience, but also it's intended to highlight our previous and our new partnerships. The old style of food banking was very much a reactive business where we would wait and see what loose cans and boxes people chose to donate, and then we would share that food. And we are much more strategic, much more proactive, but also we're focused on food insecurity in its context with those interconnected challenges of poverty that others are facing. And we're not dealing with food insecurity in isolation. So we wanted a way to highlight those partnerships with other organizations, but also the interconnected nature of food insecurity. So you'll hear us talk about healthcare and the impact that the right mix of food can have on the top 10 chronic health conditions and so on.
And you mentioned that food banks traditionally were more reactive. How has that changed over time?
We were really for many decades, and food banking is about a 50-year-old business. Gleaners is in, we're about to start our 42nd year. So the neighborhood level food pantries and soup kitchens and community centers have been around much longer than that wholesale distribution layer of food banking. But we have been very dependent on retail store surplus and donations. So part of what the current Gleaners strategic plan has done is really to go out and diversify our sources of food in terms of where we get it, but also to really think differently about the downstream partners at the neighborhood level who help distribute the food that Gleaners has to offer.
So can you tell us about Gleaners and what exactly your organization does? I've always imagined a food bank to be, from my experience, is going into a place and picking up food or dropping off food for those in need. Is it more than that?
It is, but even those two pieces of your example have changed over time. So Gleaners previously would go from retail store to retail store and pick up surplus food. And even that perishable food pickup didn't start until 2008. But since that time, we have worked out a process where we can teach food safety requirements, where we can equip downstream partners, such as food pantries in a community, to go directly to the retailers through the larger scale Gleaners partnerships, and they pick up the food and the food stays local. In the old days, we would send a Gleaners refrigerated truck at 50 to 60 cents per mile operating cost, which obviously now our diesel fuel costs are off the chart and they're much more than that per mile. But for the sake of discussion, say 60 cents a mile, we drive several counties away, pick up food, bring it back, put it in the sorting mix, and then turn around and send food back into that same community. It never really made economic sense or logistical sense. And now we're connecting that local partner of Gleaners, whether it's, again, a soup kitchen or a community center or pantry, to the donor sources of food in those communities. But we offer support in how to do that safely and how to do that efficiently. And we are, in some cases, helping them get the trucks or the equipment and things that they need to do that. So a much more logical and efficient system has been built in the last few years.
That's interesting. It makes me think about something that I was wondering, where grocery stores or catered events try to get rid of excess food. Usually it gets dumped. And people who see that will say, this is perfectly good food. Is this something that you work with to make sure that that food doesn't go to waste and it's brought back into the community?
We do, but I should also clarify that Gleaners has a defined role in terms of the types of food that we gather and distribute. And for the most part, it is not prepared meals. Mm-hmm. So we're providing food to families that they will in turn prepare their own meals. There are other nonprofits that specialize in other aspects of it. So you mentioned catering meals or surplus meals for caterers. That would be in the expertise of Second Helpings. So they would gather surplus from caterers or large hotels or convention sites and so on that have surplus meals that are still valid to be donated and redistributed. And then if you talk about medically prescribed prepared meals for someone with heart disease or diabetes or something else, then that's actually done through Meals on Wheels and their hospital partners that help them distribute. And then there are some places where it's a matter of access as much as anything else, say for senior citizens. In Central Indiana Council on Aging, or SECOA, actually has senior citizen congregate meal sites that they do and so on. So my point is there are different nonprofits or partners of Gleaners that help in very specific ways. We each have our niche.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's good to know, I think, because there's often misconceptions that are out there about, you know, food insecurity or organizations that are working to alleviate some of that. Are there any misconceptions that you come across often that people maybe don't think that hunger is that big of an issue?
Well, I think people do underestimate the scale. I think they maybe have mistaken assumptions at times about who was in the food line and why. Pre-pandemic, there was a short government shutdown in late 2018. And by the second missed pay period for federal employees, Gleaners was doing supplemental food distributions, even for TSA families at the two airports in Central Indiana. So federal employees that I think most people would consider middle income, we've learned are a paycheck or two away from needing help. And certainly when you see major employers shut down, even employers that have a range of pay scales, it doesn't take very long for those employees to be in a food line somewhere. So we have too low a savings rate as a nation, and we don't have emergency funds set aside in far too many families. So you could literally say people are one broken down car or one failed kitchen appliance and so on away from needing help. And when you consider the economic success of this country, we shouldn't have that many people in a precarious situation and close to food insecurity, but we do.
Right. And I think the pandemic highlighted that a lot for folks who didn't even realize that it was an issue, just because so many people, like you mentioned, were just one paycheck away, and then all of a sudden, everything was upended. Is there anything that you think can be done from the point of view of from listeners who are listening and wondering what they can do to help?
I think, well, the obvious is financial resources. All the nonprofits involved in hunger relief, including Gleaners and our downstream partners, but those that provide food in different ways, like I mentioned earlier, would benefit from financial contributions. And even in the case of Gleaners, the way to support has changed. We used to accept loose food items from food drives, and, you know, maybe a well-intentioned third grade classroom two counties away would call and say, we've got six Kroger plastic bags of food to donate, and we'd send that truck at 60 cents a mile, three counties away, bring it back here and so on. We don't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of exceptions in terms of food drives, like the National Letter Carrier food drive, that we still do. But for the most part, we're redirecting those well-intended loose food donations to a pantry or service site in the neighborhood that the food drive's happening. and you eliminate the transport cost.
Is there anything when it comes to the specific items donated? I'm just thinking recently, my kid's school had like a drive for folks to donate, and it said, please do not donate beans. Is that something that people just stereotypically will just be like, I'm going to just donate that, and it's really not very helpful?
Honestly, the most helpful is to donate the funds to let the hunger relief charity shop for the right mix, because we obviously know better than the individual donor what food is already in our warehouse and what food is not, or what food might come in from corporate or other donors versus what food never gets donated and we actually have to purchase. And that our ability to do that is strengthened significantly by having two dietitians on staff, and also working with partners like the Immigrant Welcome Center or others who can help us purchase food that is culturally appropriate. It's also strengthened by Gleaners managing since the spring of 2017 a regional perishable food co-op, which we branded Fresh Connect Central. And Fresh Connect Central can go out and reimburse farmers for some of their expenses to go ahead and harvest, clean, bag or box, and ship direct to us surplus crop that would have been plowed under or not harvested. And that the growth in that co-op has been dramatic. Prior to the launch of that co-op in the spring of 2017, we had 0 pounds of fresh produce straight from the farm coming into Gleaners. Last year, we had 40 million pounds of produce straight from the farm. And that is such healthy food that we can distribute. So some of the funds that are donated to us as cash can go to support purchasing that very low-cost produce. But also, we've now found low-cost options to purchase eggs and more milk and protein that was going to waste. So cash really does give us the greatest flexibility. And then that lets our staff dietitians and others that they work with plan menus and share recipes. And the partnership with Immigrant Welcome Center and Luna Language Services means we can share recipes and information, which we do through the Nutrition Hub on our website also. We can do it in multiple languages. We can do it in culturally sensitive and flexible ways.
And we'll be back after a quick break and continue our conversation with John Elliott, CEO and President of Gleaners Food Bank. I'm Miriam Sobe. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe, and we're continuing our conversation with Gleaners Food Bank President and CEO John Elliott on food insecurity and things that are helpful for folks in need. Before the break, we were talking with John about what types of resources folks can provide and what's most helpful.
Finances are important. There are two other things I would say in terms of being helpful. Volunteers. Pre-pandemic, we depended on volunteers for 40% of the work that got done here. The percentages have changed now, but you know, we're doing a much higher volume of work, a more complex mix of work now. And even as we recover over a multiple year period from the pandemic, we're going to need a more sophisticated mix of volunteers. We're going to need some special skills required volunteers. So people who maybe hadn't thought about there being a way for them to contribute to Gleaners or others through their volunteer skills, there really is a way. We're just complicated now, and we need subject matter experts that we haven't needed historically.
What really fascinated me also with what you're mentioning is the surplus crops being used and brought back into the community, because we often think about Indiana as a very agriculture heavy state. I'm going to speak with Paul about this as well, just about what does our state do when it has agriculture, and do we actually use it?
We need to be always focused on getting that fresh produce or the surplus food items from the closest possible location. I mean, you know, I'm a native Hoosier, and I admittedly have a bias towards helping Indiana farmers or Indiana growers and food producers when we can, but there's also a practical reason. Pre-pandemic, when we were sourcing food from California or, you know, growing areas further afield, it was $3,000 to $5,000 for a truckload to be shipped here. During the pandemic, we've been paying $19,000 and $20,000 for those same truckloads and freight costs. That's not sustainable. That's too much money on freight and not enough on food. While we've admittedly dramatically improved our operating efficiency from 41 cents a meal about 6 years ago to 12 cents a meal last year, with the quality and the nutritional variety dramatically improved, we're moving those trends in the right direction. We just can't afford to take on exorbitant expenses like some of the freight costs. So that has driven us to consider getting involved in on-site growing and other things, but certainly we're particularly on the lookout for food sources closer at hand.
Yeah, that's something I never even realized was just the cost of transporting stuff from other states, because it seems like everything in the stores these days, produce-wise, isn't generally local. So it's interesting to see the new shift in focus. And I wonder if that will come full circle and help farmers too, to sustain their business and livelihood.
Well, and farmers, you know, have so much of their production tied up in commitments to retailers or wholesalers, where the crops they grow and when they plant and when they harvest and the quality specs and so on are tied to retail contract obligations. And there's not necessarily a market for any surplus those farmers have. So, but they overplant or overproduce in order to make sure they fulfill those retail contracts. And frankly, while that's a great thing for what consumers have available in the retail stores, it has driven up the percent waste. And it highlights this long persistent problem of food insecurity. I mean, when 40% of the food is wasted in this country every year, and we have food insecurity rates that are plus or minus 15% of the U.S. population, that tells me we don't have a food shortage. We haven't figured out how to get the right food to the right place at the right time and in the right variety or mix. But all of that is a supply chain challenge or opportunity. It's not a food shortage.
That's got to be frustrating to know that the resources are out there to solve some of this, or maybe all of it, perhaps. But it's just getting things from point A to point B.
And I would add two things. So maybe I'll add a reason for optimism and a reason for continued frustration, perhaps. The reason for optimism is we are part of the Feeding America National Network. And the expertise at that support organization office in Chicago that helps all 200 food banks across the country, including us, that was where the idea to set up these six regional perishable food co-ops came from, including the one that Gleaners operates for the network. And now, as those six co-ops have built up, we're talking to each other. And we're figuring out how to move food from the one in Atlanta, Georgia, to the one in Indianapolis, or what can Indianapolis do to support another one. But also, all 200 food banks are thinking differently, and we're spotting opportunities. So there's a reason now for a food bank in Texas to capture more surplus oranges and spread them out across the network, or for the food banks on the West Coast, to capture more surplus apples and send those out across the network. And the same thing with eggs and with dairy. So Gleaners is now starting to share eggs through a new partnership across the network. So the system, the Feeding America system, is catching up, I think, with the opportunity, but it takes more resources than we can generate on our own to close the gap. We've figured out a system. We just need now enough resources to scale up to meet the need. I said also there's maybe still a source of frustration. The four federal meal programs are still a far larger share of meals for the food insecure than the entire charitable sector combined. If you took just SNAP, that is more than the entire charitable sector. By the time you throw in the WIC program, by the time you throw in the school feeding programs, and then the fourth program, the Emergency Food Assistance Program, or TFAP, is taking food that the U.S. Department of Agriculture purchases and then sending it out through Feeding America as the distribution arm. But those four programs are 4 out of 5 meals. So the charitable sector can only move the needle so far. We're not the biggest player. The USDA is. And I think people don't realize that. And so when we talk about things that people can do to help, lending their voice in support of the right policies and the right spending priorities of those federal resources for feeding programs help. If you think about SNAP being 2/3 the meals in total, if they cut SNAP in half, that's 2.5 times the charitable sector, the current charitable sector, in change. So the scale of small moves by the federal government dwarf big moves by the charitable sector. In other words, not formal lobbying necessarily, but certainly advocacy by private citizens to keep protecting those feeding programs at USDA is very helpful. Because if you cut back on SNAP or WIC or school feeding programs, those families then turn to the charitable sector, and we don't necessarily have the capacity to scale up that dramatically or that suddenly.
When it comes to the statistics in Indiana, I saw on your website that 1 in 5 Hoosiers faces hunger. Where do these statistics come from?
For the most part, that's Feeding America research, but certainly there are local sources of information. Here in Marion County, the Indy Hunger Network has done a study on the meal gap, but also you have the Polis Center and their Savvy database that has done some research here locally as well. It really varies by community, but the national standard is really Feeding America's research, and the HungerNet website of Feeding America maintains a lot of that data.
What are you seeing, though, in terms of Indiana with the work that you do? I know you mentioned that some of the things have not been getting better. More people are requiring assistance. Is Indiana doing better at all in any aspect?
It's a mix answer. And so I would say, first of all, there's such a strong connection between food insecurity and chronic health conditions. The fact that Indiana went into the pandemic scoring very poorly on chronic health conditions meant that the added food insecurity had an amplified negative effect. And that's something, I'll take it that far and I'll let you talk to Dr. Halverson for that topic. That's the first thing I would say, is the connection between chronic health conditions and food insecurity and the amplifying effect. There are two timelines related to the pandemic and food insecurity. There's a medical timeline for people who are affected by the COVID pandemic, but then there's a longer and different timeline for economic recovery. And once families are in poverty or in food insecure, they have to really deal with all of the interconnected challenges that might involve employment and education and transportation and physical and mental health and housing and other things. And it takes longer to get out of that situation. So they need to clearly understand that when the medical part of COVID is over, that does not mean the economic recovery for all affected families is also over. It takes longer.
Thank you so much for joining us, John Elliott, Gleaners Food Bank President and CEO. Food insecurity, let's define it as it relates to our everyday lives. With us as we continue today's topic is Paul Halverson, Professor and Founding Dean at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Before we get into the topic of food insecurity in depth, can you tell us about what you do in this area?
Well, sure. So I'm the dean at the School of Public Health, Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health in Indianapolis with IUPUI. And the School of Public Health was actually designed to focus on protecting and improving the health of the public. And the work in public health, you may know us from the work that we do in the realm of COVID-19, as we focused on disease prediction and helping our hospitals and our health departments. But we also are focused on everyday lives of people in our state and in our community. And one of those things that's an issue for us, of course, is food insecurity. We have thousands of people who every day wake up hungry. And of course, many of those are our children, and as well as adults. And it's not just, you know, the people that we might think are hungry. Frankly, there are a lot of people that are actually employed, that go to work every day, that are food insecure. And so this is a major issue that we face in our community. And the work that Gleaners and others are doing in this space is really, really important.
It's interesting you mentioned that the folks that we may not think about as being food insecure can also be food insecure. So I think that's interesting, because I myself would think if somebody's going to work and coming home, they might be better off than somebody who's unemployed. Is there something that leads to a situation where food is hard to come by or to afford?
Yeah, so there are a number of things that go into this. One of which, of course, is the rising cost of food, right? And we've seen through the recent inflation, the price of food has increased. But you know, it's not just recently that this problem has come up. The issue here is that fresh fruits and vegetables and nutritious foods are increasingly more expensive than higher calorie, less nutritious foods. And so it's a natural tendency, I think, in our American diet to go for foods that aren't necessarily the best for us. And, you know, food insecurity comes when people can't buy nutritious food and aren't eating nutritious foods. The issue, of course, is that it's not only the cost, but also the availability. And we know that in a number of neighborhoods, there aren't ready access to supermarkets and fresh fruits and vegetables. And so as a consequence, we sometimes refer to these areas as food deserts. But again, it is both a function of cost as well as availability, as well as the selection of foods, and all of these things come together to create an important picture, really, of insecurity of foods. And therefore, you know, one of the things that's sort of a building block that we all have in our body as we're growing up, or as we're trying to exist in society, is having good nutrition to fuel ourselves and our body. And that's a problem when we don't have access to that.
Speaking of food deserts, with a state like Indiana that has a rich agricultural heritage, have there been any considerations or initiatives to provide more community access to farm fresh produce?
Yes. So there's been a lot of work that's been done looking at community gardens, for example, and it's about really trying to match up the production of food with people that could benefit from it. But this is also one of those things that's a head scratcher for a number of us. If you look at food insecurity, actually, the greatest food insecurity is actually in our rural areas, where we're just not growing enough food, and it's not being purchased enough. And so as a consequence, again, there's a mismatch of supply and demand. And also the fact of the matter is that in a number of our rural communities, we've got people that are either unemployed or underemployed. And again, don't have access either because they're not it's not available, or they don't have the funding to purchase nutritious foods and vegetables. And so as a consequence, we have this mismatch. And so it's not because we don't know how to grow food, or essentially produce. It may be that we don't have that match of the grower, the producer, if you will, and the ultimate consumer.
Would you say, I mean, is part of the problem, I wonder, that we produce more food for animals than for people when it comes to...
Well, yeah. So if you look at it, I mean, farmers grow crops that people will buy, right? So if it is corn and food for either animals or for, you know, refined to be refined for other purposes, whether it's fuel or other purposes. You know, the farmers grow have to be able to make a living off of their crops, and so if there's a stronger demand for agricultural and industrial crops, then again, they're not going to grow the foods that we need to eat on a daily basis. The other problem, frankly, that we have is that many people have grown up without eating fresh fruits and vegetables. And so one of the phenomenons we're seeing even in community gardens is that people are given fruits and vegetables, and they may not necessarily know how to prepare them because that's not the tradition in which they have grown up. And we need to help people understand that fresh fruits and vegetables can be tasty and convenient and so forth. It's changing the culture to make these fruits, vegetables, and other nutritious foods more readily available, tasty and convenient, so that they're good options for people. But, you know, again, while there are people that are working, there are a lot of people that aren't working, obviously, that can't afford foods and who depend on food pantries and distribution centers that help fill in the gaps.
We'll be back in 90 seconds. I'm Miriam Sobe. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're continuing our conversation with Paul Halverson, professor and founding dean at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI.
Do food pantries and distribution centers offer lots of options when it comes to fresh fruits and vegetables? Because I can imagine that's hard to store for a long period of time, and it could end up going to waste.
Well, it is. It's a difficult challenge, and yet you've got organizations like Gleaners and others that have invested in freezers and refrigeration equipment to be able to purchase and to distribute fresh fruits and vegetables and more nutritious items. Again, we know that people that are food insecure tend to go for things that'll fill their tummy, right? Whether it's kids or adults, you find things that are perhaps high in carbohydrates that are initially very satisfying and stay in your gut, essentially, and not necessarily those, and again, more prepared foods, things that can be stored for a long time. So our food pantries and distribution centers are now beginning to pay much more attention to the nutritional value. But that also causes them additional challenges because they, first of all, have to find foods that are higher in nutrition, and then they need to be able to store and distribute them, and that is at a higher cost, as you mentioned. You know, food security also leads really to poor health outcomes. It's not just being hungry. It really creates or leads to a greater number of adults with diabetes, heart disease, obesity, cancer, and stroke. It increases the rates of stress, anxiety, and depression. And of course, it has huge negative impacts on children's development, both physical, cognitive, and emotional. You know, it's really, really difficult to learn when you're hungry. And increasingly, we're hearing from teachers about the kids in their class that are just so hungry that they can't really concentrate. And of course, that's one of the reasons why, you know, being able to get a nutritious breakfast and lunch at school is so very important. And we're increasingly seeing the participation of kids from all economic backgrounds really in these free breakfast and lunch programs that are sponsored by the schools. And that's been a marvelous innovation to increase and improve the overall nutrition of our children, which I think really goes a long ways. But there are huge, health impacts of poor nutrition. And people think about, well, no one likes to be hungry, but it has a profound impact on the health of the individual and communities. And that's why we really need to pay attention.
The free school lunch and breakfast program sometimes is the only food that some kids will get. Is there any efforts being made to extend it outside of school?
There are a number of programs that actually provide for the continuation of these programs, like when school is out. I mean, one of the difficulties during a holiday break, for example, is that that's where kids get their nutrition, right? And at school. And so being able to get grants so that the schools can continue to provide the distribution of these meals during holiday and summer breaks has been a really important and a great, great program, great asset. We're also seeing churches and other community organizations come together to provide support. You know, it's interesting. We're not immune. You know, you look at great, very prosperous counties here in Indiana, and you think, well, there's no real big problem in Hamilton County, for example. It's one of the highest income counties in our state, and yet there was an estimate that over 24,000 people in Hamilton County alone are food insecure. Over 8,000 children insecure. So it's not just about the sort of the average income. It's the fact that there are a number of people that lack the ability to access food, and it's all around us.
When we hear things that children are more likely to be food insecure, is that because adults wouldn't admit that they're hungry?
Yeah, so adults, I think, can sometimes figure out ways in which, you know, first of all, adults tend to want to take care of the children first. And as a consequence that, you know, they may not admit that they're hungry, but they'll want to do whatever they can for their children. But then secondly, I think adults try to be creative, to try to find ways in which to get food for their kids. Unfortunately, again, sometimes those food choices, by necessity, they choose foods that are lower cost but have high, may have high calorie, high carbohydrates, keeps the kids from being hungry at a lower cost. And unfortunately, those foods tend to be less nutritious and frankly, create some of the difficulties. I mean, one of the issues that we see in food insecurity is obesity. In part because people are making choices for lower cost, lower nutrition, and increasing the carbohydrates and other less nutritious nutrients. Again, we all need carbohydrates, but you also need protein and fats in order to, you know, balance the whole thing out. And we're finding that one of the consequences of poor nutrition is actually obesity. And then again, we have on the other side, undernutrition, wasting and stunting, which we see particularly in children that are deprived of the essential nutrients. So it is a very complicated process, and it's one in which we all, I think, can recognize. If you woke up hungry one or two times in your life, you know that feeling. But imagine that feeling with you all day for several days, and that's what some of our folks, children and adults in our community, are facing every day.
Right, and there's no way you can focus if you're hungry.
That's right, impossible. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, try. You know, I had a tough time sometimes as a kid with math. Could you imagine if you were, you know, really hungry, you could hardly concentrate on anything? I mean, it's no wonder kids don't do as well in some of these subjects in particular. So we need to give everyone a chance to do their very best, and especially our children. And of course, you know, they depend on their parents. And I guess for a lot of families, they don't want to admit they're food insecure. We shouldn't be ashamed of being hungry. We need to be willing to acknowledge the need for help, and we all need to be working towards providing solutions. You know, it's easy to get focused on really high-tech technology and so forth and so on towards the exotic diseases, and all that's important. I'm a researcher myself. I appreciate that. But there are some things that are pretty low-tech, you know, in terms of food and nutrition that every day impact our neighbors, and we need to start there with good nutrition.
With the school meals, the free breakfasts and lunches, I've seen some of them, and I remember one time seeing a breakfast bar that was like 500 calories, and I wonder, are schools also like, do they need to kind of change up their menus and make sure they're offering healthier, filling nutrition?
Yes. So the U.S. Department of Agriculture actually, now over 10 years ago, did a complete revamp of their food and nutrition menus and created new standards for healthier foods. And I was actually involved in that a little bit when I was the state health officer in Arkansas. And programs like WIC and other programs, the school lunch programs in particular, they really made a concerted effort. Unfortunately, what happens is even food choices get politicized. And so you may have seen back 10, 11 years ago when all of these changes were taking place and there was a recommendation to put more fresh fruits and vegetables in the cafeterias and kids weren't eating the broccoli or the Brussels sprouts or whatever. And again, you know, the reality is that sometimes it takes a while to change your tastes. And also we need to know how to better prepare fruits and vegetables that we may not necessarily be familiar with. And so in an attempt to improve the nutritional value, those new standards were oftentimes criticized as being things that kids don't like to eat. And as a consequence, again, the politics became more prominent in the nutritional standards. And sometimes nutritional values were exchanged for more politically acceptable foods. And those are not necessarily the most nutritious. And so as a consequence, this is another example where we need to let science lead. That doesn't mean that we should have food that is unappetizing or not tasty. We need to have good, tasty foods that are nutritious, and that is possible. And increasingly, we're beginning to emphasize that. That's also one of the reasons why we need strong nutritional education, both in our schools and in our graduate schools, and certainly in our policy making. We need to pay attention because not all foods are the same, right? So you could have high calorie, low nutritional value foods, and that doesn't really help us very much, right? So what we need are high nutrition. And again, sometimes a high calorie is okay if that's the only source of nutrition, as long as the calories are good, nutritious calories. But again, we see some great examples of low nutrition, high calorie choices, which are not really very helpful.
It's interesting because when I saw, for example, this breakfast bar, in the back of my head, I'm like, oh, it's a decent amount of calories for breakfast. But then I was like, but would you really be full off of a bar? You know,
yeah, probably not, right? Yeah, so it's like the idea of, you know, take a pill and you'll be, you know, done for the day. No, not really. You know, you need to have not just the nutrition, but you also have to have the satisfaction of the food. And so there's a number of aspects related to our dietary intake that we need to pay attention to. One is taste and the nutritional composition, but also you know, we have the need as humans to fill our stomachs, to taste food that tastes good, to be able to, it's a complex part of how we process food and store it or use it in our body. And so it really is important to balance it all out. And that's why good nutrition is not just about counting the calories, but also looking at the kinds of nutrition, the satisfaction of eating the food, how long it stays with you, the ability of that food to provide the nutrition to the cells in your body that they need to work and to grow.
Would you say that food insecurity is a public health crisis?
Food security is a public health crisis. It's not confined, you know, to people that are poor urban dwelling people. It's a rural problem. It's an urban problem. It's a problem of both working people and unemployed people. It's a problem of children and adults. Nutrition is a crucial part of the public health safety network, if you will. We all need to eat. We need nutritious foods that will allow our bodies to grow and to work each day to support the lives that we'd all like to live. One of the problems we have in Indiana, of course, is that we have our health is, we're ranked 41st out of 50 states. We generally have poor health. We don't live as long as other states in the country. And this poor nutrition actually contributes, the lack of food actually contributes to this poor health status that we have here in Indiana. And all of these things work together. I mean, most people don't connect food insecurity to heart disease, obesity, cancer, stroke, diabetes. But in fact, it's a substantial source of the problems that we're having with the chronic diseases here in our state.
Do you think more people are talking about hunger now? Is this an issue that's on more people's radar, or is it something that we only think about as the holidays come around?
Well, I think there is more awareness around food insecurity today than there has been, thanks to, I think, a lot of public education. But it's still not a prominent issue. And certainly, it does become more top of mind on the holidays when people are enjoying a holiday meal and they recognize that not everybody is able to enjoy the same kind of meal, and so that it helps create some awareness. But this is an everyday issue. It's not just a holiday issue. And organizations like Gleaners and other organizations that focus on food insecurity, you know, we've got a whole lot of churches and other community organizations that, you know, day in and day out, they work to try to make sure that people have access to good, nutritious foods. And sometimes they're able to succeed and sometimes not. I mean, sometimes their cupboards are bare. Sometimes they don't have the most nutritious foods to distribute. And that's why, again, I'm so great. It's great to be able to see the food banks really focusing on increasing the distribution of nutritious foods. And we're also beginning to see nutrition education, which is so important, along with things like our community gardens and neighborhood food distribution outlets. We're beginning to see a recognition of the importance of grocery stores in neighborhoods. Some neighborhoods have been years without having access to fruits and vegetables, and now we're beginning to see greater emphasis being placed in this realm. It's an important part of building a strong community.
Is there a misconception that hunger and issues with food is something outside of the U.S.? I feel like when I was growing up, it was like, finish your plate or, you know, kids in another country are going to be starving.
Yeah, yes, that's right. I heard that a lot myself growing up. Yes, I think that's right. I mean, it's easy to imagine kids in other continents, you know, going hungry, and you see the pictures on television or hear the stories on the radio about kids starving. You don't normally think of that happening in the United States. But in fact, it does. It happens not just in the United States. It happens here in Indiana, and it happens right here in central Indiana. If you look at the increase in population, you know, Marion County has seen substantial increases in population, but a huge number of the increase in population comes in at people that are below the poverty level, that are unable to access foods, nutritious foods, who don't know where the next meal is coming from. And so that issue is so important for us all to recognize. We take for granted, you know, you reach in the refrigerator in your pantry and you have what you need. But that doesn't necessarily translate to everyone.
Thank you for joining us. Paul Halverson, professor and founding dean at the Richard M. Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yasin. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.